Hello and welcome to the fifth season of Somerset Stories, the podcast which explores the lives of the people who live, work and create in Somerset. My name's Lewis Webb and we're back with brand new weekly episodes where I get to share the stories of some of the inspiring, creative and successful individuals and families that make this beautiful county their home. Since announcing this season on social media, I've had a lot of really nice comments from listeners and all your feedback is always appreciated. So if you'd like to send us a message, you can email hello@somersetstories.com. My guest this week is Colleen Bauer, director of a new annual science festival launching in May. Summer Science brings together 65 organisations from around the region to showcase and celebrate the amazing world of science, technology, engineering and maths. Colleen's extensive experience in the education industry, as well as her natural curiosity, are vital to spearheading this event, which aims to connect local people in an engaging way with some of the innovative, fun and pioneering developments taking place on our doorstep. What's more, this isn't her first festival of this kind. She developed Malta's first large-scale science festival in the Gozo Citadel. We met with days to go before the event and discussed the critical role of STEM in education and a range of other great topics. Colleen, welcome to Somerset Stories.
Nice to be here.
How are you? How's your week going?
It's a little bit frantic at the moment because we're in the run-up now, the final run-up to the Summer Science Festival. So I would say that every day brings fresh, I won't say hell, but fresh interesting things to focus on.
Good. This is episode 70 of Somerset Stories. We're quite proud of reaching that milestone. Are you a regular podcast listener at all?
I listen to podcasts on a regular basis. I go for a long walk every day. It's my kind of stress reliever. And while I'm walking, I listen to podcasts. Yeah, I'm a great fan.
Is there anyone that you'd want to listen to as a guest then?
Oh, well, I mean, I love hearing people like Giles Brandreth and Stephen Fry, just because they've got such a command of language. I could listen to their voices for hours, whatever they were saying. So someone like that would be great. But I'd need a bit more time to think about properly who I would actually like to invite. It's like when you ask people about dinner parties, who your ideal dinner party people would be. You know, I can never think when put on the spot.
So we're going to be talking a lot about science and technology, obviously. But I wanted to get a bit of a feel for how you've got to where you are now. So firstly, why don't you tell me a bit about your early life, where you grew up, what your parents did, that kind of thing.
Oh, gosh. It's a long time ago. We moved around a lot, not for any reason. I mean, no one was in the forces or anything like that, but just for various circumstances. So I don't feel as though I belong anywhere. I was born in Canada. Was in London for primary school, was in Essex for secondary school, etc. And then we moved with various husbands and jobs, moved all around London, home counties, that kind of thing. So don't really feel as though I've belonged anywhere, which is great, actually, because I think that has probably been why I've ended up doing a lot of travelling in my sort of later years. I don't feel particularly rooted anywhere. So, yeah, that was kind of early years. We were a single parent family. My mum, Irish, education, top value in Irish families. And so it was very much about learning, doing well at school, that being the gateway to all that you want to achieve in life. And it was, really. I did my A-levels in a grammar school. I actually got into Cambridge, but decided, one of these few people decided not to take up the place in the end, which was a bit unusual at the time, and went into the workplace and very soon fell into the recruitment field. And really, at the time, which was the early 80s, it was the time when recruitment as a business was professionalising, really taking off. So I was in the recruitment business for nearly 20 years and ended up managing director of a couple of different companies, moved on from one, which was a medical recruitment company, to another, which was actually a specialised telemedicine service, well ahead of its years, really. So 20 years in business was mainly in the recruitment field.
Your professional background is, like you say, characterised by lots of different roles. You mentioned recruitment, but there's other things as well, and a lot of different places, a lot of different locations. And to me, that would imply that you're quite a naturally curious person, would that be fair to say?
Yeah, definitely. And I'm also a bit of a control freak. So I think in my early career, in the business career, it was about getting onto the top of a company so that I could actually take it somewhere and be the person who made the direction, set the direction and took the organisation there. But yes, absolutely, curiosity. And I think you never stop learning. And I love it. I actually love learning. And I have quite a strong opinion about the idea that school sometimes switches people off from learning instead of switching people on to learning, and that you've got to make up for it the rest of your life, really, because there's just so much out there to find out about.
We will get into that in a little bit. Speaking of schools, what do you think your teachers would have expected you to go on and do?
Oh, definitely an academic career. I mean, when I was at school, I was a girly swot. And it was, you know, I had to get A grades, et cetera, et cetera. I was the classic kind of high achieving girl in a girls' school. And so they would have definitely thought I would have gone on to Cambridge and then gone on to be some kind of don and had an academic career. And actually, it was quite a decision on my part not to do that, because I knew I would end up in that role. And once I'd gone out and had a gap year and seen there was an awful lot of the world out there, I didn't want to do that.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you got into teaching then?
Well, there was a bit of a road to Damascus, actually. So I was coming up to 40. I had three children, and all of them had entered into teenage years and all kinds of issues that come in teenage years. And I sort of started reading a few psychology books to sort of try to work out what was going on with them, and just thought, I need to learn about psychology. I really love this. So I decided to give in my career, go to university, and I did a psychology degree at the age of 40. And when I was doing that, I realised I loved the world of education, and so decided that I would do a PGCE and become a teacher, and started teaching back in 2005. And I did 5 years in the UK as a psychology teacher, and then went to Hong Kong and did another 4 years out there teaching psychology in an international school on Hong Kong Island. So really loved that world. I love young people, and I love the curiosity and the left of field thinking that you get with teenagers. So I absolutely adored it.
So psychology was something that stemmed from your own personal and family circumstances?
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to know why people do what they do. Why were my children doing what they were doing? Why was I reacting the way that I was reacting? So that was the original thinking. And then once you get into psychology, you realise there's just so many different branches of it. It's absolutely fascinating. And in fact, that hasn't changed. You know, that hasn't stopped. When I was doing my psychology degree, and it's only, 20 years ago, the emphasis on neuropsychology was quite limited, and it was all about really cutting up the brains of dead people to find out how the brain had worked. And of course, since then, things like MRIs and PET scans and all of those things have come in, so we can actually see what a functioning live brain is doing. So if I had my time again, I would be doing neuroscience rather than psychology, because that's, you know, become a real area of fascination.
And did your learnings help with parenting teenagers?
No. I think the thing when you study psychology is you realise there are no answers, there are only more questions, and that is the way that it carries on.
You mentioned during that time you were based in Hong Kong for a little while. Was that a daunting move at all?
No. I mean, what happened was my third, my youngest child left home and went to travel around the world. And I thought, well, what's the point in me staying behind? I've always wanted to travel. I haven't got any children at home anymore. So I had a look. It was actually a snow day in a British school. And I was at home having a look on the internet, thinking, where could teaching take me? So I applied for four jobs in four different places, Vietnam, Malaysia, Thailand, and Hong Kong. I got four interviews, which I wasn't necessarily expecting, and had my pick of those four locations, which was just fantastic. And Hong Kong won because it's a fascinating city. And I suppose I knew a little bit more about Hong Kong, just read a bit more about Hong Kong. So it was a bit more of a known quantity. But even then, it was a huge, huge surprise and culture shock. It was amazing.
Were there any particular highlights from your time there?
Oh, too many to mention, I think, really. I mean, I had, so for the first year, and my children will tell you this, I acted like I was in my first year at uni. It was kind of, there was so much to do, so much to see, so many good nights out, which I, as a working parent, hadn't really been having. But also the children, the students in the school that I was teaching in were amazing. It was the most rewarding time I've ever had in my whole professional career, was to teach those young people, because they loved learning. And it was very different, I have to say, from the UK environment, where, you know, there's quite a lot of resistance amongst teenagers. It's not cool to learn. Parents aren't particularly supportive of learning in terms of backing up what goes on at school, that kind of thing. In Hong Kong, it's completely different. They love to learn. They push you as a teacher to take them further. And that is delightful. You know, it's absolutely delightful. And, you know, yes, they're all high achieving. But I mean, my feeling is that everyone can be high achieving if the circumstances are right. And there the circumstances are. Possibly goes a bit too far the other way, because you do have some families in Hong Kong that actually beat their children if they don't get A grades. Now, I wouldn't be an advocate of that. And some of what we had to do, and this is where the psychology came in quite well, was to really help counsel some of those young people so that they set their learning in a proper life context. It's not the be all and end all. So you can go too far, I suppose, the other end of the spectrum.
While working in your roles in education, that was 10 years from 2005
yeah.
to 2015?
2004 to, yeah.
So a lot changed during that period of time. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that smartphones, social media pretty much redefined human existence, and education has clearly been impacted by that. So what do you think your biggest takeaway from your time working with education institutions was in relation to that change?
I think the time that I was involved, we weren't seeing as much impact on student life as there is now. So I left in 2014 was when I was last teaching. I then went into education recruitment, which is, you know, I'm still in the world, but I wasn't actually doing direct with young people. Now, when I was in the school in England, it was actually forbidden for the youngsters to have their phones, you know, in school, or certainly on in school. And we didn't have computers in every classroom. There was a trolley of laptops that if you had to book, you could have a laptop lesson. So actually, it wasn't that integrated. It was very different when I went to Hong Kong. There, we were encouraged to incorporate all this technology into the classroom, and I could see it would be amazing. So it would be much better for me to be having a classroom full of people on their phone, finding out more about what it was I was telling them about. And they were so quick at doing that. It was incredible. And the other thing, I would be using quite a lot of vocabulary that maybe as bilingual students, they might not have come across before. Their natural language might have been Cantonese or whatever. And what I found them doing was using their phone very quickly to just quickly translate a word if I'd used it and they hadn't picked up exactly what it meant, which was just incredible. So they were showing me how technology could facilitate education, actually, which was fascinating. And there, they all had laptops, and everything was done, using laptops and that kind of technology. And I can see a whole lot of advantages for it. I can see one big disadvantage in that the exam system is still a written system, and actually using laptops and not using your hand to hold a pen puts you at a big disadvantage when you go into an exam hall. So we actually had to do some lessons on how to write fast and all of that sort of thing. And yeah, so I think there were some interesting things. But I think since then, I mean, goodness, things have changed so much with AI in particular coming in, ChatGPT, all of that. And I think what I can see is I don't think schools are actually as quick as they could be in making best use of that. What the tendency tends to be is to ban it and to check that people aren't using these assistive technologies. And actually, they should be incorporating it, I think.
Okay, we're going to talk about STEM. First things first, what does STEM mean, and what kind of things does it incorporate?
Well, STEM stands for science, technology, engineering and mathematics. And what it doesn't incorporate might be easier to talk about, because actually, if you think about it, there is nothing in this world that doesn't come under one of those headings, in fact. There's often an artificial divide made between STEM and the arts or humanities. But actually, what a lot of work of the scientists or technologists or engineers is all about is, in fact, ensuring that humans are able to accommodate to the world, and that the world is adapted to facilitate people surviving, thriving, etc. So I think that's a very artificial divide. You can't be creative without having some understanding of patterns, for example, if you're an artist, which is also part of mathematics. Or, you know, you can't, you need to use certain tools in order to be creative. And those things are come under the heading of technology or science. So it's quite an artificial divide. I think STEM incorporates everything, but in terms of popular use, it tends to sort of look at the kind of I suppose what we now consider more the futuristic industries of the country, which is where the sort of young people in the future are going to end up working, really.
So let's dive into this a bit more then. At a national level, what is our current educational system doing well when it comes to STEM?
Well, I think in recent years, there's been quite a focus on STEM in schools and at universities to try to increase the numbers of students taking it up. So that, quite different from when I was at school, mathematics is now the most popular A-level, I understand. So and science degrees are also a very popular choice. So I think what the education system is doing well is actually showing the importance of STEM. I think, though, there is still a lot of work to be done in terms of knocking down or busting myths, really, about what STEM is and what the sort of person who pursues a STEM subject or career is like. There is this kind of vision of white coats, laboratories, boffins, this type of thing. And also, if you're in a family where no one is working in any of those kinds of fields, there is a kind of feeling that, oh, well, you know, that's the science. The science is done over there. And in fact, during the pandemic, it really got to me when we kept hearing people saying we're following the science. There's no such thing. Science is an ongoing dynamic process that's taking place all around by myriad numbers of people. And I think we're not getting that message across to people early enough. Research shows that young people need to really have those possibilities opened up to them before they leave primary school, in order for them to, when they're in secondary school, have a self image as being someone who could pursue those kinds of careers. So we really need to do more at a young age to show that the fun stuff, which I think primary schools do fun stuff, but that leads to actually really quite serious stuff, and that there is a connection. I don't think those connections are well made at the moment.
You mentioned the perception of white coats and labs and things like that. It is very easy when one thinks of science and technology to automatically frame those thoughts in the context of big multinationals like GSK, who have millions in research, or those sort of very ivory tower style institutions like Imperial College or MIT and those kinds of places. Why do you think that is?
It's a good question, and I don't think I've got the answer to it. I don't know why we do. I think they probably spend quite a lot of money on advertising and PR and all sorts of things to be in the public view so that we hear about them more. And because they are large organisations, they have a lot of clout, and so they get coverage, etc., in the media. And so it's what shapes public perceptions is a kind of whole area of psychology, isn't it? It's very difficult to pinpoint one thing. But I work as part of what I do at the moment. I'm a consultant for the Baker Deering Trust, which is the organisation that runs university technical colleges. And what they do is they focus on STEM education purely, and they do it in conjunction with employers. Now, what that has shown me and all of the students that go through university technical colleges is that actually, wow, STEM can be really groovy stuff, like all of the creative production that goes into the Elstree kind of cluster and the Salford Keys cluster, the sort of digital production that goes behind all of the films and the podcasts and all sorts of things. that incorporates, STEM is part of all of that. You have to understand a whole range of things in order to be able to produce those sorts of things. It can also be, you know, it's about building houses. It's about making roads work. It's about thinking about the transport of the future. I mean, anything that a little girl or boy has an ideal about when they're growing up, actually, STEM will be involved in it. And we need to do more to get that across, that it's actually not separate, it's part of your dreams.
How do those kind of perceptions of the sciences happening over there, how do you think that affects rural areas like Somerset?
Well, I think it's a really interesting point, actually, in Somerset, because the perceptions, and this is well documented by when people are interviewed about why they've chosen Somerset as either their home or their holiday destination or whatever. The perception is it's rural, it's pretty, and it is, it's beautiful. It's agricultural. You can see very obviously, sheep and cows. And it also is all about producing lovely, delicious food, cottage industries. I think a lot of the advertising that's done even by the food companies emphasises the cow in the field rather than the processes that go into the production. Wyke Farms is an example. Now, as part of the festival that I'm doing, Wyke Farms has taken part. Now, yes, they are a farm, but they have, what they're showcasing at the festival is their whole green energy that they've put a lot of time and effort into developing a way of making cheese that uses green energy. So it's very high tech. But what we are encouraged to look at is the pretty grass and the cow and whatever, harking back to the past in a way rather than the future. So I think I've forgotten what the question is now. But basically, Somerset is perceived as a sort of heritage, cultural, tranquil place, and that there is no industry. And actually, there's industry all around. It's just it's not what industry in people's perceptions looks like.
So you're right. We do have a lot of industry in the Southwest. And as you mentioned, food production is perhaps the most visible. And it is one where there's a huge potential for STEM subjects and areas to have quite a massive impact, not only on the success of those businesses, but also the way in which they move forward and become more future-facing as well. Is that right?
Yes, it is. I mean, if you look at any kind of, so agri-tech is really the kind of umbrella term for all of this stuff. And it's huge. And we do have some research centres in Somerset on exactly that topic. We've got the Agri-Epicentre, which is a national organisation, but it's all about research into how we can make agriculture more allow it to take more advantage of STEM. And it has got up at Shepton Mallet their robotic milking parlour, which is a kind of showcase of how digital technology can actually help with farming and with the costs of farming, making it more cost effective, that sort of thing. And so that's going to be something that people need to be aware of. But there's also things like the chemicals that are used on the ground. There's soil, getting most out of the soil and soil management. There's a whole science behind that. There's looking at energy that actually powers the things that the farmers need and making those energies sustainable, taking advantage of the natural environment in order to harness those energies. So really from every step of the way, from managing the animals through to managing the soil, through to managing the production processes of what comes out of those animals and soil, that's where you've got science to look into how best to do it. You've got engineering to come up with the ingenious solutions to be able to provide some kind of mechanical or digital machine in order to be able to make that happen. You've got mathematics because that's involved in every step of the way to sort of calculate those things. And you've got, obviously, I mean, the result is that sometimes you've got some quite heavy technology. Might not be large technology, but it's quite quite complicated.
And are there any areas where you would say we are really driving innovation from kind of, excuse the pun, but ground up way?
In Somerset?
Yes.
Well, the west of England in particular is really leading the way in a lot of aviation technology. There's the whole hydrogen initiative. So obviously, with the push for net zero aviation, which, you know, the country is committed to, the aviation industry is committed to, there's a big consortium called Hydrogen West, where all of the large aviation organisations are working together to develop hydrogen-powered aircraft. So that is leading edge, and it's happening in Somerset. There's all sorts of other technology advances that are being made by aviation companies, and there's quite an aviation cluster with companies like Leonardo. You know, we've got sort of Bristol Airport, we've got the whole Bristol Air Consortium, etc. Lots and lots of big minds really working on that field. So that's the leading edge area. Obviously, in terms of energy, there's a lot going on in Somerset. You've got the Hinkley Point C being built, the nuclear reactor being built over in the coast. And as a sort of consequence of that, there's a lot of smaller organisations, small to medium enterprises, that are built up to supply that, and also to be inspired by that in order to come up with other applications, etc. And then throughout Somerset, you've got people working on sustainable energy, like I said, you know, with regard to, for example, Wyke Farms with their anaerobic digesters, etc. So you've got energy as being quite a key thing that Somerset is leading on. You've got aviation and you've got agri-technology. And I think the other thing that the area has does really well is a lot of life science research. If you look at the universities that feed the area, Bristol, Bath, UWE, Exeter, etc., there's a lot of interesting developments taking place on the life science and bioengineering, biomechanics, all the things that support health development.
You mentioned a couple of things in there, quite a few. One of them being around sort of sustainability and net zero. There does tend to be a little bit of jargon. I'm going to throw one more into the mix, which is green tech, which is one I've heard. So what's the easiest way of summarising that and making that accessible to people who maybe don't come from a scientific background?
I think it's about what it does, isn't it? So green tech, or, you know, net zero aviation, what's it all for? The purpose of it all is to save the planet, if we want to, you know, boil it down into a sort of bite-sized message. And I think that's the way in for a lot of people. People don't necessarily come at it from thinking, oh, what are all the processes that are taking place? They want to know what the outcome's going to be. And you can get people to sort of buy into a vision. And then if you show people that actually to achieve that vision, these are the kinds of areas of knowledge and areas of work that need to be done in order to get to that point. That's the way in, as far as I'm concerned. I think that's what people are looking for solutions, aren't they, to problems that they can recognise. And I think there's probably no one who isn't bothered in some way by climate change and the effect that we're having on the planet. So those industries that help minimise that are going to be ones that people are going to be wanting to know more about.
You mentioned AI earlier as well. Are there any pockets of excitement within that space happening around Somerset?
It's happening all over, of course, and I'm not aware of any pockets, let's put it that way, so I couldn't tell you about that. What I do know is that there's a lot of work taking place, certainly, again, university-led, but things like robotics is something that is being developed in all sorts of ways, and we're going to have that at the festival. The idea of swarm robotics that Bristol Robotics Laboratory is working on, which is fascinating. It's like looking at ants, but actually getting robots to behave in the way that swarms behave, and what the applications of those are. Absolutely fascinating. But, you know, AI is involved in the background to all of that. You've got other people coming. So, for example, we've got Exeter Engineering Department. They've developed tiny robots that will actually travel through people's bowels to diagnose bowel cancer. So you've got all kinds of things, and all of those are controlled by AI. So it's there.
You also talked about how your thoughts on AI being incorporated into how education works and deals with it. What's your view on the sort of change that these technologies will have on the careers of those students who are currently in education and growing up with this technology?
Gosh, it's almost impossible to say, isn't it? Because even 20 years ago, I wouldn't have known, and I was working in schools, I wouldn't have known about some of the careers that exist today to be able to tell them about them. There's been exponential change, and it's always going to be changing. I think what schools have to get young people ready for is constant adaptability and change, and to be able to accept and to move mindsets with the technology that is developing. So I think it's that flexibility and that approach to understanding and taking on board new things on a regular basis. We need to make sure that they're able to do that. And in some ways, I think that's where our national curriculum really falls down. Because if you think about where did that come from? It came from a set of subjects that were valued in Victorian times. And I feel actually very strongly that what we really need now is a very different kind of curriculum in schools. And it's one that actually I think the university technical colleges do really well. It's one that is aligned with the world that they're going to come out into and start working. So we should be learning about engineering in schools. We should be focusing on apprenticeships and practical learning as much as academic learning, and giving them the same value. And we shouldn't be, you know, I think the divide between subjects is completely artificial. In life, it doesn't work that way. And I think schools do a disservice to young people in actually making them think that maths sits in this set of activities and nothing else in the world, or the same with science, or the same with frankly, art. All of those things overlap in the real world, and we should be getting people to understand that that's the way their future work will be. And in fact, I didn't realise that enough until I actually did do my, went back to university at as a middle-aged person and did the history of education. And I didn't realise that the curriculum that we got was the subject of lobbying by organisations that were powerful, like the Royal Geographical Society, to get geography on the curriculum, or, you know, the sort of, obviously, the Royal Society itself to get science on the curriculum. It was a power play by various organisations, and therefore it didn't come down from God. It was something that was negotiated, and it can be renegotiated. And I do think that this emphasis on, you know, oh, we need to go back to the basics. Well, maybe, maybe not. Maybe the basics are different these days. What are the basics these days? We probably need to re-examine all of that.
Let's talk about the festival then. Where did the idea for it come from?
Okay. Well, I think you have to go back a little bit, because I set up a festival also in Malta. I lived in Malta for 4 years, but I wasn't living on the main island of Malta. I was living on Gozo, which is the second island of Malta. Now, Gozo is a very rural area. It's a tiny island, really tiny. There's only, I think, 30,000 people living on the entire island. It's green, it's agricultural, etc., etc. And in the middle of it is a huge citadel, which dates back from the 1400s, and it's, you know, an absolute marvel of medieval science and technology, actually. It was built to withstand, you know, all kinds of attacks. It was cunningly designed so that people, if they did land on the island, would get lost in the citadel, etc., etc. And that citadel was refurbished by the European Union. And when I first went to live in Gozo, there was a big reopening of the citadel. And when I was wandering around, I just thought, this is a marvel. This is an absolute marvel. But also, I found that by talking to people, that the EU money had been given in order to, one of the conditions of the EU money was that the citadel had to be used for future learning. And I started thinking, well, wouldn't it be great? This is a marvel of the science of the past. Wouldn't it be great to have something about the future on this citadel that kind of encapsulates the glories of the past? So we developed a festival there. Now, we have exactly the same set of conditions, actually, in Gozo than you have in Somerset. It's rural, it's perceived as pretty, it's perceived as this is where the food and drink comes from. All the things we were mentioning earlier about Somerset, same sorts of things. And yet underneath it, of course, if they don't develop for the future, then they would be dying as an island. So there was a lot of hidden science and technology. So that festival was set up. It became successful. It ran for 3 years. And I came back to England specifically to do something bigger, because I had got the bug for it by then. And of course, then the pandemic hit. So I arrived, I bought my house in Somerset, and I've had to wait for 2.5 years in order to put this plan into place. But Somerset has the same kinds of conditions. And so it was always the plan to develop a similar festival and bring it to the rural people who otherwise have to go into cities in order to access these kinds of engagement opportunities. In Malta, Gozo people had to go over and get a ferry to go to Malta in order to do that. So it's the same kind of set of conditions.
Unlike having a citadel to hold an event in, the festival isn't all in one place, is it?
No, it was very definitely the choice that what we wanted to do was we wanted to highlight rural areas, but we needed some kind of infrastructure. You can't literally have a festival in just a field in the middle of nowhere. Well, I suppose Glastonbury does, but it's a different type of festival. So what we wanted to do was to highlight South Somerset in particular, because it's in the bottom 10 of 387 local authority areas in the UK for access to science engagement opportunities. That's according to a British Science Association survey that was done in 2022. So it's actually, there's a huge need for it in South Somerset in particular. So it had to be in South Somerset, and Castle Carey and Bruton are two very small towns, but with amenable town councils who really saw the value of having a festival like this in the area. And there are 12 venues across the two locations that are available for us to use, and they were able to accommodate the kinds of activities that we've got.
So what kind of activities have you got going on?
Right, well, we've got a whole range of things. So sort of showcase thing is this big science fair. That's going to be taking place on the cricket field in Castle Carey. There's going to be a huge marquee with several stands inside. There will be a big ocean dome provided by Incredible Oceans, which is going to sort of show people what it's like underneath the sea. There's going to be the Royal Navy coming with their big tent as well, with lots of all sorts of machinery inside. And there will be everything about that science fair is interactive. So people can go to a stand, there'll be something interesting happening, they can have a go at something, they can touch something. So it's going to be very, very touchy-feely and getting you involved. Next to the science fair, there's going to be a stage, and on the stage there'll be a whole range of activities happening throughout the day, starting with the Lord Lieutenant of Somerset, who's going to be doing the official opening of the festival itself. But we've also got a couple of rounds of I'm a Scientist, Get Me Out of Here, which is a bit like I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, where audience participation, you vote for the scientist that you want to last to the end, if you like. And we've got a whole range of scientists talking about, a bit like a balloon debate, really, explaining why they should be saved, which will be fun. We've also got going on that stage, we've had a schools challenge running, which has been sponsored by Tata Consultancy Services. And we've got the award ceremony. The final three winners will be announced on the stage, and they young people will be given the award for being third or second or first. So that's going to be a bit of excitement as well. So that's all happening on the field. Everything else is happening inside a building. So we've got all kinds of other things going on. We've got a whole range of talks. So we've got 20 hour long talks taking place throughout the day, half of them in Castle Carey, half of them in Bruton. And they're on all kinds of topics, from how does the sun work to how whales lost their legs to electronic noses, to the future of food. I mean, a whole range of different, there's something for everyone there. They're probably more geared towards adults or older teenagers. And they're also probably going to be a quiet place to sit down and just have a chance to sort of sit and absorb rather than go around and actually be active. We've got a programme of shows taking place at Carriford Hall. So we've got Science Circus in the morning. We've got Hack Your Brain and a whole range of psychology type of show related things in the afternoon. And we've got Exeter Science Centre doing Operation Earth, which is about how to save the planet, but Earth is brought to life, etc. So it's quite a lot of fun. They're all fun. They're all for young, very young children with their parents. And then we've got workshops taking place in Bruton and Castle Carey. Workshops are hands-on activities. You do it for an hour, maximum 30 in each workshop, and you will go away with something that you've produced or something that you've learned. So we've got, again, workshops that range from building a balloon-powered car and understanding forces, all the way through to mathematical modelling and how to build and code your own robot. So there's lots of interesting things there. And then over in Bruton, we have a health hub. And that is where University of the West of England, Health Education England and Somerset NHS have all come together to produce a sort of mini fair over there, all to do with health engineering, biomedics and health itself. So there'll be the chance, there's a teddy bear hospital, so people can bring their teddy and put their teddy through a range of tests to see how doctors diagnose. We've got all kinds of things like echocardiograms and ECGs that you can have a go at and understand what's behind that. There's a Minecraft section which is going to showcase medical engineering. Lots of fun activities going on over there. And then aside from all of that, we've got some of the local organisations. Wyke Farms is one, Mill on the Brew, which is an outdoor activity centre, and Carrymore Environmental Centre. They're running tours of their estates, if you like, and showing the sustainable elements of what they do and how that translates into the work that they do. So I think there's something for everyone. There's 85 different activities happening throughout the day.
So I know you're not supposed to have favourites, but are there any particular things that you're most looking forward to?
Well, I suspect that I won't get the chance to enjoy the day at all, because as the organiser, I think there'll be a lot of running around and things to sort out. But I'm a Scientist, Get Me Out of Here is going to be a lot of fun. You know, it's a very much an audience participation. And it's actually very much in the spirit of what we're trying to do overall, which is to show that scientists are real people. They'll make fools of themselves, but they're like you and me. And I think that's going to be quite an important thing. I definitely think that from my own point of view, the health hub, I think, will be fascinating. You don't often get the chance. I mean, you go to hospital, you have to go for tests. It's normally because you're ill and you're not really thinking about the marvels of medical technology. So it's quite nice to get the chance to look behind the scenes and find out actually what does go into making us well. It's not just about doctors and nurses. Of course, they do an amazing job. But actually, it's awfully a lot about technology these days as well. And it's really interesting, I think, to see that. But I mean, they're all my favourites. They're all my children.
It goes without saying that obviously this has been a huge effort to planning this. So what do things look like behind the scenes? It's not just you, is it?
No, it's not just me. It's not just me. I've had a very fantastic implementation team. It's just a small team of us of five people. And I've had one person, Darren, who has been working on the logistics side. And he very fortunately works at Talis UK and has he's been brilliant at recruiting a large number of people to work and give their time free to help with the logistics of the festival. So I'm really grateful to them. I've had Louise Gardner, who has been absolutely amazing as our website guru and our social media person, helping to spread the word and working every day to promote it in every possible way. So that's been really useful. Eve Anderton is very well known in Bruton. She used to be with the Bruton Town Council and is a kind of fixer over there, but has also been very much instrumental in developing the schools challenge and making sure that the schools are taking part in the event. And Mark Ebden, who actually works for STEM Learning as his full-time job, and he's been working on how we're going to evaluate the festival and make sure that we collect data to make it better, really, next year. That's the organising team. On the day itself, we're going to have 70, 75 volunteers who are going to be helping. They'll all be wearing yellow T-shirts, and visitors are encouraged to use them as the information points for them. They are, in terms of background, they're either ex-teachers, they're STEM ambassadors, or they're students from Bath University studying STEM. So they're knowledgeable volunteers, and they are really looking forward to taking part as well. So we've got the community involved in a big way, actually. All of the organising team is from the local area. And then at each venue, we've got a venue manager, because obviously I can't be everywhere. And those people are all local people as well. So I'm pleased that it's very much of the community.
So as this is the first time that it's been run in Somerset, you do have experience of putting events like this in the past, but there must have been some moments of panic or worry in the run-up.
There are constant moments of panic and worry. I mean, nothing goes 100% as it's supposed to. this has been brewing for 18 months. I first started, I set up the charity, first of all, 18 months ago, and then obviously spent quite a lot of time applying for grants and funding. And the worrying thing about that, of course, is that you don't know whether you're going to get the funding, but you have to proceed as though you have got the funding. And luckily, we have got some really great sponsors behind us, but we didn't know any of that until around about October, November time, and had to do a lot of work on the, you know, on a wing and a prayer in a way. So that was pretty hairy. And then we've been working on the actual content of the festival. I had to get people locked down and into, interested in doing something that I couldn't show them. And that was really hard. Next year will be a lot easier from that point of view, because we'll have photos, we'll have all sorts of things. And it's quite hard for people to tie into a concept without actually having any kind of evidence in front of them. So that was also quite difficult, but we have got 65 organisations lined up, which is great. And then it's about, well, how do we fit all of the activities that people are proposing into the infrastructure that we have in the area? So finding the right venues, making sure we've got the facilities, etc. That was another headache at the time. And then we've got the marquee that we're going to have on the field and all the issues that we've still going to have about whether weather will scupper things, at the last minute in some way. There could be a tornado, who knows? There's all sorts of things that can go wrong when weather gets in the way. So there's all of that going on. Hopefully we've got, 9 days left? I'm hoping that everything will go to plan from now.
And what's the reception been like when you speak to people in the area about this?
Really positive. Start with, it's like Science Festival. Oh, I'm not sure about that. And then when you explain, and this is really interesting, actually, because it's exactly that. Science Festival, that's not for me. Then when you explain, well, actually, there's this going on and that. Oh, really? Really interested. So it's kind of, in a way, it shows why we need to do this. People do have perceptions of science as not being necessarily something that's of interest. And then when you think, well, actually, yeah, but we're talking about cars, we're talking about trains, we're talking about energy, we're talking about food. I mean, then people think, oh, yeah, well, actually, maybe it is something to be of interest. Kids love it. I mean, I've had people come up to me, because I've been giving out leaflets and all this kind of thing, saying, it looks really cool. So it does look really cool and it will be really cool for kids. So what's lovely is that young people, when exposed without their preconceptions, love the idea of all these things. So no, it's been positive. Obviously, our interest has been to get the message spread as widely as possible and to as many different groups of people. So young people seem to like it. Grandparents, actually, I've had a lot of interest from people who say, oh, I'm especially getting my grandchildren over for the day. I don't know, parents are quite busy, so we need to make sure that the message gets across to parents. It's a free day out for you and your children on a bank holiday. What's not to like about that?
I mean, I think from my point of view, it's something which is going to definitely entertain the kids. They can explore almost what they want to, how they want to. So, yeah, it seems like a no-brainer.
And a really important thing I haven't said, actually, is that also to make it as easy as possible for people, because both towns are quite challenged for parking. That what you don't want to be doing is getting in your car and driving from one venue to another. So we have free festival buses, shuttle buses, that are doing a circular route all day long. So no one needs to wait longer than 20 minutes for a bus that will take you to the next venue or the next town. So if you're doing something with your kids here and they want to go to the Teddy Bear Hospital over in Bruton, then all you have to do is hop on the bus and, you're there without having to worry about getting your car, finding parking over in Bruton, etc., etc. So we really want people to use those shuttle buses. They're being sponsored by Leonardo so that they can be free for everybody.
So finally then, it all sounds very convincing. I think you put forward a great argument for coming along. But what would you say to someone who might still be on the fence?
I would say don't miss out on the chance to be part of the first Summer Science Festival. In years to come, when this is an annual event and people look back to the start, don't you want to say that you were part of it and you were actually there at the inaugural festival? It's going to be fantastic fun for everybody. I challenge anyone to tell me that there isn't something on this programme of interest to them. And really, we want all of your support, because we need to make this a firm annual event.
Colleen, we're now going to play Somerset Location or Obscure Movie Title, which is the game where I give you names and you have to tell me whether you think it's a place in Somerset or the title of an obscure movie.
Right, okay.
So we'll start with Taylor's Orchard.
That definitely sounds like a place in Somerset.
It is a place in Somerset. It's in Chiselborough.
Okay.
So started with an easy one. Your next one is the Dawn Wall.
Ooh, tricky. I'm going to say that's a place in Somerset. I can't imagine that as a film title.
It is a film title.
Okay.
From 2017. It's a climbing documentary. Number three is Cut Bank.
Yeah, that would be a place.
It's another movie.
Gosh, I'm not doing very well at this.
It's a crime drama from 2014 starring Billy Bob Thornton.
Okay.
Okay. Number four, Scrumbrum Lane.
Well, I want that to be a place in Somerset.
It is a place in Somerset, yeah.
Where is that?
It's in a place called High Littleton.
Okay.
So Scrumbrum Lane is quite memorable.
Yeah.
Your next one is Hills Green.
Well, it was how green was my valley? go on, because I haven't done very well on this, I'm going to say it's a film title.
It is a film title.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah.
Improving performance over this. Next one is Steam Along.
Got to be a film, surely.
Steam Along is a place.
Of course it is.
It's a road in Taunton.
Okay.
So you've got two more, and you're on three so far. So if you get these two right, you'll be above 50%. So penultimate one is Danger Close.
And it's close and personal. Is it danger, isn't there, as a film? Now I'm going to say it's a place.
It's a film.
Oh!
It's a war documentary from 2017.
Okay.
So your last one. And this is for 50%. Cold Nose.
Place.
It's a place.
Yay. So I've ended up with a distinctly average performance.
Yes. It's mostly guesswork for most people. And you've come on bang on the money in terms of what guesswork normally gets people. Colleen, before we go, where can people find out more about the festival and how to get involved?
Right, so our website is at summerscience.co.uk, and Summer Science is spelled S-O-M-E-R, like Somerset. So summerscience.co.uk. And all our social, so we're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're on Instagram, and you can get to that through at Summer Science. So on in any of those channels, you can find our pages.
And it's 1st of May. Starting on at, what's the time of the first event?
Well, 10 o'clock is when it's open to the public. So the science fair will be open from 10 o'clock. And we have got various events starting all around the two towns at 10 o'clock. But it's open from 10 a.m. through to 6 p.m. There is no tickets necessary because everything is free. And so you need to just show up to the things that you want to take part in. The timed events, we recommend people come bit earlier to make sure they get the chance to get in, so they're not disappointed.
Colleen, thank you so much for your time. It's been really great understanding more about the festival and talking more broadly about science and technology in general. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Somerset Stories. If you liked it, you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find us on social media at Somerset Stories or email hello@somersetstories.com. Somerset Stories is a Whitstone production, and music is provided by Jezzar under Creative Commons.